lonesome train. I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. It's many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Old pal to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champagne, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board.
And we have a guest, Michelle Duane. Do you say it, Duane? Say it your way, because I don't think you say it, Duane.
It's Duenis.
Duenis. Yeah. Oh, I saw May Berenbaum yesterday, and I said you were coming, and I don't think she understood that it was you that I was talking about. So are you French in background? Did you come up to Mississippi to Kentucky?
My family's from the Alsace-Lorraine region originally. Actually, both sides of my family are from there. But the story I've been told is that we're German, and our last name used to be Dunes, but that we had changed it to sound more French when France had control over the region at some point in time. And we never changed our name back. So.
I wondered about that. So, okay, I encountered Michelle at the Pollinatarium exhibit at the farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she kindly elected to come this morning at short notice. And tell us what you are going to do with the National Pollinatarium.
This week, it just started. It's National Pollinator Week. And since 2007, we've been celebrating it on campus. And so we have a whole bunch of events this week to celebrate. Actually, today at 2 p.m., we're going to have a lecture on native bees by Dr. Alex Harmon Threet. She's a newer professor in the Department of Entomology, and she studies native bees. And so she's going to talk about some of the native bees that she studies and the really cool places that they live today at 2 p.m. at the Pollinatarium. And if you don't know where the Pollinatarium is, it's on the corner of Lincoln and Windsor. There's an entrance that's on Windsor, and the building's a little hard to see from the road, but once you drive down it, you'll recognize it immediately. It's covered in a really beautiful mural of pollinators.
And if you look carefully, there's a few beehives near the road.
Yeah, you'll pass a few beehives on your entrance into the Pollinatarium.
And then there's a little prairie,
mm-hmm.
which is part of the Pollinatarium. And wow. Native bees. Tell us a little bit about native bees. A little starter for people who might go. Because native bees can be very, very small, mm-hmm. and they can be very hard to get to harvest for honey or anything like that. So tell us a little bit about native bees.
So I think what most people think about when they think of bees are honeybees, which are not native to the United States. I think they were brought over in the 1700s to the U.S. from Europe, but honeybees originally are from Africa and then diversified out from there. So they're not native to the United States. They've only been here for a few hundred years.
So often they're referred to as Italian bees.
Yeah, there's lots of different subspecies, and the Italian honeybee is one that's pretty commonly used in the United States. But outside of the honeybees, there are thousands and thousands of native solitary bees that you can find in the United States. There are small sweat bees that people might be pretty commonly familiar with. There are mason bees that you can also find. And these do not produce honey like honeybees. They live inside hollow sticks, or they live in the soil. About 80% of bees on Earth live in soil. So they either live in sticks or in soil, and they have solitary nests. So they'll lay one or a few eggs, and then they'll... some bees, like leafcutter bees, will provision the nest with leaves and cover it with leaves. But then when you see them out on the flowers, they're collecting nectar and pollen to feed to their young when they become larvae. And they're much more diverse than the honeybees, and they're also really, really important pollinators. But for the most part, they're solitary, which means it's one bee living on its own. It mates with a male. It produces a nest with one or a few eggs, and then it does not. Most of them are not very social.
So they're sometimes very small. You almost have to have a magnifying lens to photograph them.
Yeah, some of them are really, really small. And so they live in very, very tiny sticks inside of them. A lot of native bees, particularly like brambles from like blackberry or blueberry bushes, they'll nest inside the sticks. They'll kind of chew out the inside and nest inside there. Yeah, some of them are really, really, really tiny, and some bees can be really, really large. So there's a huge diversity in size.
Large.
Yeah, bumblebees are kind of a special case because they are social. They live underground. A lot of people, I think bumblebees live very similarly to honeybees because they're social, but they have a very different nest. It's underground, and these little tiny pods are where they produce all the young. And then they do have some division of labor in their colony like honeybees do. So some bees will nurse and stay in the hive and take care of their sisters, and then some will go out and forage. But it's not as complex as the social system that's in honeybees.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that they prefer bare patches.
Yes.
used to find them where people had done wheelies in Busey Woods when Busey Woods was not a public park.
Yes, it's really, it's particularly difficult for the really small solitary bees that live underground to dig through mulch and the other things we like to cover our yard with. So they really like bare patches of soil.
Oh, I'm right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But bumblebees are very industrious, and I have found them in lots of different places, house crawl spaces. We found one, I can't remember the name of the gym, but we found one living in the greenery outside of a gym in Champaign that we tried to dig up. And when we dug about 2 feet deep to try to remove this colony, and it ended up being inside of a like buried railroad tie that was really, really long. And they had found this one little hole inside the railroad tie, and so we basically had to put all the bees back into the colony and bury it again because there's no way we're going to remove it unless we had a saw to cut through the wood.
Yeah. and this was a railroad tie, you would have metal.
Yeah, right.
and you would have to deal with rocks that get into the
tie. Yeah.
Wow. Well, tell again that people can find out about native bees this afternoon.
So this afternoon at 2 p.m., we're going to have a lecture at the Pollinatarium on native bees by Dr. Alex Harmon III. It starts at 2 p.m. It's at the Pollinatarium. But we also have a lot of other things going on this week to celebrate bees. We'll have food guides up at Common Ground Food Co-op that tell you which of the foods are pollinated and what insect pollinates them, or mammal, or bat. And then we'll have a trivia night at Pizza M where you can test your pollinator knowledge. We're the Pollinatarium, our pollination museum, is part of the Master Gardener's Garden Walk Tour. So you can stop by and see all of the beautiful flowers that we have planted outside the Pollinatarium now.
What's flowering right now?
Right now, we just started having bee balm come up, which is, echinacea, which is the coneflower.
Purple coneflower.
Yes, bumblebees love purple coneflower, so I'm really excited about that.
Uh-huh. But they also like monada or...
Oh, but they love bee balm, too. Yes. I haven't seen too much of that, but
It's not in flower yet.
Yeah, we have penstemon coming up, too, a lot of that, and bumblebees like that as well, so...
Okay, well... Michelle is also an entomologist. So we had a bunch of volunteers here, and one of them was sawing down a dead tree, which is a serviceberry tree. And although she's a specialist in bees, she might show you how she takes an eyeglass and looks at what's on the log. And it's a little lumps, not as good as the one we had outside.
Yeah, so
there's
a huge, for those of you listening and not able to see this, there on this log are some clumps of very small bright red larvae of some sort of insect that are all over this tree, and so there are some adults, and what I think, since I do study bees and I only have a very general knowledge of other insect orders, and since I don't have a microscope with me, I'm pretty sure these are some sort of true bug that's laid a bunch of eggs on the tree. And I can't see them well enough with the magnifying glass to tell if they are actually causing disease in the tree. I can't tell if they're a kind of bug that would actually feed on the tree or if it's just... a predatory species of true bug that just decided to nest on the tree. But I should be able to, if I collect some and take them back to the lab.
Uh-huh.
I can tell what they are.
Show people the ocular, because we do have video.
Oh, okay. And, just a little magnifying
glass. This is a watchmaker's, and you put it in your eye. You put it like so. And so your both hands are free.
Oh, I was using it wrong.
Yeah. So then you go right down... on the log, you look, and oh, they're eggs. They're red eggs. Wow.
Yeah, whatever this is, it's really booming on this tree, which makes me think that it's feeding on it, but I can't really tell yet.
Uh-huh. When you have, the serviceberries are trees that are not much bigger than a shrub. They don't grow big enough to lift up buildings, and we're near to buildings. So we've purposefully made a prairie forest that's near to buildings, and we don't want the buildings lift up to have a dance. You know, it's not good for the walls. So serviceberries are probably regrowth succession berries. That means that they will live for perhaps 17 years or something like that, and then they'll get all sorts of bugs in them, and this is what we're looking at, and then they'll die. I had thought that because we've got our little pocket prairie on a landfill, that this might be dying because it was hitting something scungy underneath, but it's probably not. It's probably got a disease that it might get anywhere when it gets older, and what happens is you have a regrowth succession tree that is replaced by other plants, perhaps an oak tree or something like that. It gives it shade to start off with, and it eventually dies. A common one often is maple, or it might be an alder, or something that lives for a certain time and then dies. So that's just because early in the week... A couple of students had the temerity to be looking into my front window, which has kind of got a lot of junk in it. And I said, told them what we do is gathering up old railroad lines for a prairie that's almost extinct. And so I just showed them the pocket prairie. And then they called me up and said, we'd like to help. So I had them to remove a mulberry tree. And the mulberry tree is around a advertising sign. And we have a contract with the advertising sign people to not block the visual corridor. And mulberries, probably most of you know, very invasive because birds eat the fruiting body and then they spread it around. And it also grows very quickly, and it is also very tough. So we cut that out of there, and I have to say thank you. And they're going to come back again, so we might take them to Pope Prairie in Rantoul, where we have a gravel pit, and the prairie is doing very well and is starting to have echinacea and roses and even a few sunflowers are starting to come out.
Yeah.
And so very, very interesting. So this is part of my week, and we'll put that one away, and then we'll bring you the alliums. This is a horticultural plant, but the alliums are out at this time of the year, and if the native ones are also out at this time of the year. And tell me, are these pollinators? Do they?
I've been looking very carefully at the allium in downtown Urbana to see if I've seen pollinators, and what I've seen are syrphid flies, but I haven't seen any bees attracted to them, and I imagine it's probably because maybe some smaller solitary bees might be attracted, but definitely not honeybees or bumblebees. They'd be too heavy to hold on to the flowers.
Yes. Tell us about bumblebees. When they get heavy, you can see them with their legs are full of pollen.
Yes.
And they're heavy. So when they leave one flower, they almost drop down in order they have to climb up, you know, like 3,000 feet to get to the next flower.
Yeah.
They're loaded.
Because bumblebees are so heavy, they can really only utilize certain types of flowers that have really good landing pads for them. So anything that has like an opening and then the bumblebee can land on it and crawl into the flower is really nice. But they do like clover, even though sometimes they're too heavy for things like clover even. I've seen them land on clover and the clover flower will fall over. And,
they're disgusting.
I wish you'd been on me with this walk through Urbana yesterday because I saw this ornamental. I don't think it's native. That was in someone's yard. It was on the corner, near the corner of Illinois and Cedar Street in Urbana. It was these huge flowers that looked like they didn't produce any nectar, but they were covered in pollen, this white pollen. And I just saw a bunch of bumblebees having a party on this flower. Just, I've never seen bees act like this on a flower, but they were zooming around, just running all over the flower, covering themselves in the pollen. And then how they actually get it onto their legs is they have to fly and hover. And then they take their legs and they rub it all over their bodies, and then they take the front legs and rub it into a comb on their back legs, and that's how they actually get it onto the baskets on their legs to take home. And so these bees were just running all over these flowers, like covering themselves in pollen and then flying a little bit and putting it into their pockets. And I've never seen bees with pollen pockets so packed. Like, it almost looked like they were going to have trouble flying home. They had so much pollen. I really wish I knew what the flower was. I'll have to take a picture and send it to you.
Yes. So do they talk to each other? Do they take their antenna and talk to each other about? Do they get excited with each other?
We don't think they have as elaborate of a communication system about where to find food as honeybees do, but we do think they have some sort of dance language. But it's definitely not as coordinated as honeybees. It's not. We haven't figured it out so well that we can interpret it ourselves and figure out where a floral source is. It's just kind of them running around really fast on the
so
comb in no particular
who,
direction.
Are specialists in bee language.
Yeah, yeah. Carl von Frisch is the a very famous honeybee biologist who kind of decoded the honeybee dance language, which is very coordinated. So what they do is they kind of dance around in a figure eight on the comb for their sisters. And when they go through the straightaways, they waggle their abdomen back and forth. And the speed at which they waggle their abdomen, I hope I'm getting this right.
Like a dog wagging his tail.
Yeah, it indicates, I think it indicates how the quality of the food. So if it's really, really good, they'll waggle really, really, really fast. But if it's not as good, they won't waggle as fast. And then the way that they move this figure eight on the comb is in relation to the sun, so it gives a direction to the bees on where to fly out when they leave the hive. I think I'm interpreting this wrong. I say bumblebee, so sometimes I forget all the details about honeybee dance language. But I think actually the frequency of the abdomen, I think that indicates how far away it is. And then how long that they do the figure eight dance on the comb is how good that is. So if it's a really, really good food source, they'll just keep doing it and trying to spread the word amongst their sisters. But the frequency with which they waggle their abdomen, I think, tells how far away it is.
They have muscles. The agriculturists are using them to pollinate tomatoes and things like that because they can get into a flower and use your shoulders.
Yeah, actually, honeybees cannot do that, but bumblebees can, yeah. And they're really good at it. What they do is they land on the flower, they detach their flight muscles, and they vibrate them really fast. And so what it does is, especially for things like tomatoes with these porosidal anthers, which means they're the pollen's in this kind of like a salt and shaker. And so when the bee lands on it, it's kind of like shaking salt out of a salt shaker, and it gets all over them, and then they can go and pollinate the next flower.
Wow.
And they seem to know which flowers they have to do that on as well. So I don't see bees doing the buzzing on flowers that don't actually need the buzz to remove the pollen.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I was at the farmer's market, and I had another flower that you might say something about as far as bees are concerned. This is a subtropical flower. It's called a red hot poker. And I'm familiar with this from my Australian background. Is this the sort of flower that you would see bees on? Or in your tropics, you have so many more insects.
Yeah. This one, I don't think I would see bumblebees. Wouldn't particularly like this flower because there's not really anywhere for them to land on the flowers. But I think probably smaller sweat bees and smaller solitary bees and flies. Because it's red, I'm more inclined to think that it might be hummingbird pollinated where it's native.
Yes.
Hummingbirds really like red colored things. Uh-huh. That's why all the hummingbird feeders you buy in the store are red.
Okay, and you put red sugar in there.
Yeah.
Okay, so we take photographs and put them in afterwards. And if you have photographs, we've had Kim Campbell on and discussed hives and mm-hmm. supers and things like that. But you're on a different trip.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, the bumblebees. How many bumblebees in a colony?
It depends on the species.
I'm thinking 10 or 15. Oh, yeah. Okay.
So there's one species that lives around here called Bombus oricomus. It's one of the largest species you're going to find. It's really big. And they only have they only produce probably like 50 workers over a lifetime, which is not very many.
How long's a lifetime? Months?
So the queens, they come out of hibernation in the early spring. I'm pretty sure that's cued by temperature. And so they'll fly out, they'll find pollen and nectar, and then they'll start provisioning food to build up a nest. So they'll build a single pot for themselves, and they'll fill it up with pollen and nectar, and then they'll get enough to feed a larval cluster. So they'll make a little ball that's mixed with eggs and pollen and nectar, and then they'll plop their face in front of that little pot, and they'll just sit on those eggs and incubate them for 2 weeks.
So it's like a clucky hen.
Yeah, very similar. And she'll have this little bucket of food to feed herself while she's in there for 2 weeks. So that's why you kind of see a lag, is you'll see the queens, but then you won't see workers for a few weeks because she's in there incubating her brood.
And the workers are feeding her.
Yeah, well, not yet. So no. Once they hatch, then those workers will start to take care of a next brood cluster. So once she makes her first brood and she gets her first set of workers, then she can just kind of become an egg-laying machine. And the workers will take care of their young, and they'll be the ones that start flying out and collecting food.
And how long will they live?
They'll live until about the end of the fall.
A matter of 6 months at most.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And so oricomus only produces about 50 workers, we think, over its lifetime. That's about the average number. But what they do at the end of the season is they produce a really high number of queens. So the progress over the season, and then at the end of the season, it's time for the queen to lay other eggs that will become queens to hibernate for the next spring. And so she'll lay those. We call them gynes. They'll go out and they'll mate, and then they'll be fertilized and ready to produce eggs for the spring, and then they'll go and they'll find a hole to hibernate in.
And so they'll go through the winter, and it's, from what you're saying, it's fairly deep in the soil. It's like 2 feet or something.
It depends. Some species prefer to nest on the top of the ground and cover themselves with grass. So they'll nest in grass piles, but some species will nest underground as well. So Oricomus produces like very few workers, but a whole bunch of reproductives at the end of the season. Another species that you can find here is impatiens. It's really, really common, and you can actually buy it for greenhouse pollination. If it has a natural space to develop in, it can get really large colonies in the hundreds, with hundreds of workers. But relative to that size, they don't produce nearly as many queens at the end of the season as an Oricomus would relative to the number of workers.
So can I hire a semi-trailer load of bumblebees?
I don't know if you could hire a semi-load, but you can buy them from a company called Coppert. That's actually where we get all our research colonies are from, this company that rears them. So you can buy them from Coppert, and they'll send you them in a cardboard box. And then all you have to do is lift the plastic box inside there out. There's a bag full of sort of like a honey solution in the bottom. You uncap that, and then you put them back on there, and then you open this latch, and then they fly in and out of your greenhouse to pollinate the tomatoes.
Well, yes. So for younger people who are listening and having to decide what they want to do, and they might not know what they want to do yet, you're going to be a specialist in bees.
Yes, very soon I'll be an official. Well, bumblebees.
Yes, you're headed for your PhD, and you have to finish your thesis.
Yes.
And you'll be at the Pollinatorium for a year yet.
Until December.
And so it's a fun place to be, and it's got murals all over the outside of the shed if you're looking for the Pollinatorium, and that's interesting. And I was wandering around after the farmer's market. Let's say our mission is to sort of report on environmental issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so bees are just one of them. And I wandered over to the common market, and they have put in planters that are very deep, so that you have the deep-rooted prairie plants there. And they also have them insulated so that they won't get cold in wintertime. And they're all starting to flower in traditional manner. So the golden Alexander is already flowered. Some thimbleweed is out in flower at the moment. And there's some daisies out in flower, and the purple clover, prairie clover, not sweet clover, is coming out, and it's just rather wonderful. So I took photographs of this and talked to people who were interested, and they were kind of amazed that this little prairie is right outside the common market. So then I walked around the corner, and around the corner is this, we talk about energy, and there are all these people working exercise machines. And I've been in there very many times. It's a multinational, but you can't imagine how much energy is being produced by those people. and we have huge, huge air conditioners on the roof to absorb all the heat. And so I keep asking, where is this team of half a dozen grad students that could put a dynamo on all that machinery and produce enough light for Lincoln Square? In Brazil, they're getting prisoners. Prisoners get exercise making lights. And so I took a photograph of that. I couldn't go in and take a photograph of the people, because that would be unfair, because they didn't know they were being photographed. No, I just took a photograph of the outside.
So then the next thing I did was I went to Weaver Prairie. Mm-hmm. And Weaver, Mr. Weaver, was a politician of great note. And he died fairly recently, and this is a memorial to him. And so it's an interesting place. It's on East Main Street, and there was a sort of swale. And in the swale, you could walk around in this type of weather. You could get a 6 inches of water. And yes, it was there yesterday. It was like that. And the trees are savanna trees, so they're like a cloud with the branches out, spread out, mm-hmm. not like a forest tree which goes straight up. And I planted a prairie. It might be, I would guess, about 40 acres or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Across the road is Bob Faden. He has a house with a whole bunch of prairie in front of it, too. And they've made the concrete trail meander a little bit, so you walk through the prairie to some extent, and it's a regrowth. It's not an original prairie, but it's a reconstruction. So you have a range of prairie, and I met up with two people who were organizing a field situation there. One was Matt Bulk, who is the Banner Park District naturalist, and the other was Norton. I think he might be Ralph, I'm forgetting the first name, but his relatives who had the name Ralph Norton, and he grew up in Tolona. We talked a bit, and there was also a glacial erratic there, and David was worried. He's worked with geologists, and he knows what a glacial erratic is. So, David, explain what a glacial erratic is.
Oh, boy, my turn to talk. Really briefly, first of all, it's 1:30 the hour, so we should remind folks you're tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and we are community radio for East Central Illinois. This is the Prairie Monk Show for June the 14th, 2015. So we all know that there were ice ages where there was ice everywhere. It's hard to fathom. There's so much water out there, and as water gets cold and freezes, it takes up more space. There's so much water out there that when it got really cold, all the water started pushing up out of the Great Lakes and whatever, and started pushing down, and it reached as far into what's now the United States that it reached down to, at least in one of the ice ages, down towards southern Illinois. As it expanded all the way down, it didn't just politely say, excuse me, as it went across the ground. It would smush everything in its way. It may be frozen water, but it's kind of tough when it's ice. It's frozen. And so as it went over the earth, it would scoop up the earth. As it went over things that were rock, it would crunch up the rock and break pieces of the rock off. Well, there was no clean up after yourself policy back then. As the ice age ended and it got warmer again, everything just sort of fell out of the ice. It might have moved back a little bit for all I know, but it pretty much just sank down through the ice as the ice melted, and wherever it happened to have gotten to, that's where it stopped. That did wonderful things for Central Illinois. It gave us the earth that we have here that gives us like the best growing soil in the United States. It also brought all of these pieces of granite and whatever else from all around from north of here, and they just got dumped here. They don't belong here. They don't come from here. They're from hundreds of miles away. And so the geologists give them the name erratic because it has nothing to do with the geology of our entire area. You've got sand, and you've got gravel, and you've got clay, and you've got earth, and then you've got erratics. And so, yes, some of it's such a popular...
The bigger ones fall out in Canada.
What's that?
The bigger glacial erratics may be the size of a house, so they're very heavy and they drop out north of here. And so we have very few glacial erratics. You can pay $200 and $300 for a glacial erratic if you want it to sit in your front yard. So,
and that weight actually comes to their advantage. People aren't going to just walk into your yard and say, hey, I like that, and walk off with it. So you can find you can find lots of tiny little pieces of this stone that's from far, far away. But if you see the really big ones, it gives you an idea of something. And I couldn't even tell you'd need a geologist to come on here and tell you where some of these, the stratigraphy
yes,
of what you're looking at.
Yes, some are granite, or some of them are sedimentary. And some of them are striated because they have been scratched across the landscape with ice. We have a gravel pit prairie in Rantoul, which has what is called glacial till. That's the smaller version. There's an announcement about who put together the park district over 100 years ago, and it's a plaque on a glacial attic. So then I went on to Route 150, where there's a water problem and there's an accumulation of water. And so I took photographs there, and we'll put a few of those up on the television. The water eventually has to find its way from the like of Beringer Commons and Walmart, all the way to almost to Mayview Cemetery, Mount Olive Cemetery, and it has to find its way across the fields to the Salt Fork River. So that was what I was doing there. And then later in the day, I went to the 3 miles of abandoned railroad bed between, or abandoning railroad bed between Bonneville and Seymour, and we really hope that that corridor will remain open so that we can perhaps sometime have a historic trains from the Railroad Museum to come into Champaign. That's not going to happen immediately, but we would like to leave the railroad intact. So I took a look at that, and then we have at this time of the year, we have volunteer mowing. We have Department of Transportation people who mow way over onto our ceanothus or New Jersey tea and take out our prairie, because there is a neatness syndrome and there's also job there. And so we have to think about whether we put in no trespassing signs. I can't put in no trespassing signs because we have power lines, and under the power lines, the Ameren does not want trees to grow. So you can't say no trespassing because we have an agreement that they can trespass to get rid of trees. But we really don't like them to put in herbicide that takes out the broadleaf plants and all our pollinators. So what they use is a glyphosate that is specific for broadleaves, and so we end up with a grass prairie instead of a truly multidimensional, perhaps 50 species regular prairie. So that's sort of what I've been at. I also went to city meeting, and there's been a slot for a replacement for Region 1, and that I found very interesting. Just there were several different applicants, some of them very organized, and some of them coming from the very black part of the community. One is an opera singer and organized in that sense, and it covers the North End and also campus and over towards Mattis Avenue, I think. So I found that interesting, and how do we work with these people and how do we preserve? So I'm going to see the mayor's people this coming Tuesday to debate the 3 mile of prairie that might come out. So we're hoping that the railroad will stay intact, the elevators will use it for grain, and that we'll be able to work with the right-of-way on either side of the tracks. Unfortunately, some of it is already been taken over for farmland, so sometimes the corn and soybeans are right up almost on the track. So you do what you can and how you can, and we hope we can't do an interim trail use agreement because Canadian National doesn't want to do that, and you have to have the cooperation of the Canadian National. But that's the sort of thing we talk about generally. But I want to talk to you. Tell us a little bit more about even the biochemistry. Are you a biochemist, a bee biochemist?
I'm not a biochemist. I would actually say almost at this point that I'm more of a population geneticist than a bee biologist. That's what I've been doing for most of my dissertation.
So you've been going to Mexico and following these creatures.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do they migrate?
No, these bumblebees don't. The species that I study in particular doesn't migrate, but it's found from Mexico all the way to Panama.
Okay. And it's like the Italian bees is having a hard time. Tell us about its diseases and why is the population getting lower?
So there are lots of reasons that bumblebee species in particular are declining worldwide. And one of the factors being looked at the most right now is the transportation of non-native bumblebees for commercial pollination. And one of the most striking examples of how that can be so disastrous to the native bees is in Chile and Argentina right now. There's a native species of bumblebee there called, actually I think it's mostly in Argentina, but it's called Bombus delbomii. It's one of the, I think, one of the most beautiful bumblebee species. It's enormous. The queens.
You love these bees.
I love them so much. The queens of this bee can be almost up to about 2 inches long, and they are bright orange. They're beautiful, beautiful bees. But they are, I think we're actually going to add them to the endangered species list. I'm part of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, has a bumblebee specialist group, and right now we are trying to assess the species status of all the bumblebees in Mexico, Central America, and South America. I'm part of that committee, and so I think we're going to actually add this beautiful orange bumblebee to the endangered species list. And there is some really strong evidence to show that the importation of bees from Europe have been very play a really important role in the decline of this species in its native range.
Well, they have their own problems with mites and stress.
And so part of it is not just because of the bees coming in. So in either in the 80s or the 90s, they brought this two species from Europe to Argentina for commercial pollination. They brought Bombus terrestris, which is used really widely in Europe for commercial pollination. And they also bought Bombus ruderatus. And so what we think is that these species, when they were brought in, they bought their pathogens, they brought their parasites, and transmitted those to the bees that live in Argentina. And it's really, really been affecting this Bombus delbomii species. Another thing is that they've become so high in number is that they outcompete these guys for flowers. So they're limiting their food resources. They're giving them all these diseases. And so those are some of the things that we think are the reason that this species is declining so quickly, is because of these non-native species being imported.
But I think you said to me that you were going to do something about nutrition. You were going to find out what these characters were eating.
Not right now, but maybe for the next step in my career, I might start looking at bumblebee nutrition. So a large part of bee declines worldwide, one of the factors that we think has been playing a really important role in this is the decline in the nutrition that bees are getting. It's very evident in honeybees. We ship them across the country. We plop them in a monoculture crop for 2 weeks, and they eat only that crop for 2 weeks. So it'd be like eating, like a person eating the same food every day for every meal for 2 weeks. And then you ship them up, you package them up, and then you send them somewhere else where they eat another single food source for only a few weeks. And so it's really... it just makes a lot of sense that wouldn't be good for any organism to just eat one thing all the time.
Yes, I worked with beekeepers, and they would go onto a sort of prairie on the coast. And it had multiple flowers, and they would overwinter there. But as soon as it became spring and the flowers would come out on the eucalypts, we would pack them up and... Mm-hmm. two or three trucks, and take them 100 miles to another site, which is just what you're saying, specialized food.
Yeah, and so, but that's also a problem for native bees as well. They're not getting shipped all over the place like honeybees, but I mean, Illinois is a perfect example of how much we've reduced their food supply. We grow soy and we grow corn and it takes over, and we don't have all these native prairies with all these diverse flowers that they can feed from a bunch of different food sources. And so what I'm hoping to look at is what the role of nutrition actually plays, and when you feed a nutritionally poor diet, what actually happens? What are the consequences of that? So if you feed a queen a single food source, or you limit her the amount of pollen she can eat, or you limit the amount of nectar that she can eat, how does that affect her workers in the long run? How does that affect the number of queens that she produces at the end of the cycle? If there seems to be so if she gets really poor food at the beginning of the season, it's entirely possible that she just may produce, 50% as many queens at the end, and you've just cut in half the number of bees that an individual queen can make. And so we think nutrition is really important in that, and I'd like to really see what feeding a bee a poor diet actually does to its development.
Now, the Europeans seem to have put a close on some herbicides.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. There's some problem that gets into their system.
Yeah, so it's not specifically with herbicides, but there is some evidence to suggest that neonicotinoid pesticides are pretty damaging to bees. And most of the research has been done in bumblebees, not in honeybees. We can't say for sure that it's kind of sensationalized in the media, and a lot of people think neonicotinoids are now the main cause of colony collapse disorder. But obviously, it's a much more complicated problem than that. But there are a few studies in bumblebees that show that when you treat them with realistic levels that they might encounter in the field of neonicotinoids, they're probably actually going to encounter them more than honeybees because they live in the soil. And so a lot of crops are seed treated with neonicotinoids and they're put in the soil. So it's reasonable to assume that bumblebees are encountering much more. Any soil nesting bee is going to encounter way more pesticides than a honeybee because they don't live in the soil. But when you treat them with realistic levels, there have been some studies that show that it affects their behavior, and it also affects their development as well. So how many eggs a queen can lay. It also affects how they get back to the hive. So sometimes they can get lost on their way back.
Yes.
We've seen some behavioral effects of the pesticide.
If you compare this with brain synapses,
mm-hmm.
the synapse can be affected by the chemical that you're
right.
looking at.
Right, and that's not too surprising to find because neonicotinoids are very closely related to nicotine, and we already know that that has a neurological effect in lots of organisms. Uh-huh. And there are some, it's completely unrelated, but there are some studies that show that bees actually, some flowers produce nicotine in their nectar, and some bees are actually really attracted to the nicotine that's in flowers,
so they're
as well as caffeine. Yeah, so
wow.
It can serve as actually nicotine and caffeine can serve as an attractant for pollinators. Sorry, that was a little bit of a tangent, but herbicides are not directly. We don't have any evidence to suggest that herbicides are directly harmful to pollinators, and that you put an herbicide on and it kills it. But what's the problem with herbicides is that they're very heavily applied to things like Roundup Ready crops. And then those kill any sort of weedy species that they may feed on that might be in the margins of the crops or planted around it. And then you're just completely eliminating any sort of food
yes.
that might be available to them.
Wow. So you belong to the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. Department of Entomology, and Mae Birnbaum has headed that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to have a program on weft. It was
knits,
gnats, and insects. So you will have a very theoretical background, but you also have an applied background. You run around with a bee uniform every once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have a public relations. So you're a public relations person as well as a theorist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'll imagine you with a lab. So if you have a bunch of high school students like mm-hmm. I've been working with just this week, how would you work with them? Would you have them work in a lab to find a chemical? Would you have them to dissect your insect to see whether their pollen is and how their sacs are formed? Or would you have them out in the field like Weaver Park and look to see whether Weaver Park has a range of pollinators, that flowers that they can... So, yes, there yesterday was the penstemons.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. they can work on a penstemon. And they can work on monad or bee balm if it comes along. And then the echinacea is there too. So some of you that are out there that are listening should go to Weaver Park and to Meadowbrook Park and to other places like Liz Kirby has been working up on 160 acres on the Sangamon River up near Fisher. So there's a range. So how do talk to my high school people who are coming out and have to go to college and want to do something that's in the biological field?
I would, if I had some high school students that I brought into the lab, I would probably try to give them experience in all of those different things that you mentioned. I wouldn't limit them to one study because at least when I started college and was a biology major, I originally wanted to be an art history major, but I ended up in biology. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it. I figured I was going to go to med school because that's just kind of seemed like the path that a lot of people took, and it seemed like the logical choice, and I'd make a lot of money. And so that's where I started when I started college. But then I made sure to experience as much of biology as I possibly could. I worked in two different cancer labs, doing molecular research. I worked with insects over the summer. I started doing surveys of endangered tiger beetle species in Indiana over the summer, and that's what I really fell in love with. But I also really fell in love with the molecular work I was doing for cancer research. So when I went to graduate school, I knew I wanted to do something with insects and something with evolution and genetics. And so that's...
It sounds like statistics too.
Yeah, well, not... I have a complicated relationship with statistics and mathematics. I wasn't very particularly good at any of it through college or high school.
But you learn fast if
yeah,
you have to.
Yeah, you have to.
It becomes part of your research.
Yeah.
you have units within the university that can help you
do that. And I would say probably the best learning tool for me for statistics was when I had to end up teaching it to students. As you never learn something as well as you do when you're preparing to teach it to someone. So that really helped me a lot.
So, but to have a background in mathematics is probably helpful.
Yes, I would say any high school student who wants to do biology, I'm sorry to tell you that you're going to have to do lots of statistics, you're going to do lots of mathematics, and I would also very much encourage you to learn some basic computer code as well. Because bioinformatics is it's already here. Bioinformatics is already an incredibly important part of biology. And that involves being able to work with really large data sets and also being able to work
so
really
you
well
have
with
a
computer
huge
programs.
Computer that can do it over and over and repeat things. But you haven't said anything about chemistry.
Oh, I don't actually do very much chemistry at all. I mean, I have to understand it. For
looking
the
at nutrition,
well, not yet. I'm not looking at nutrition, not yet. I'm right now. I'm doing population genetics, and so what I do mostly, most of my research has been in the lab. I do. I'll put quotations around field work because I just collect the bees into ethanol when I find them, and then I bring them back here. Uh-huh. I don't do any sort of like traditional ecological experiments in the field yet. Anyway, I hope to do that. So what I do is I bring the bees back, I extract their DNA, and I amplify certain parts of the DNA that I'm interested in, and then I compare those different parts of the DNA between the different bees that I have to see how they're related to each other.
And you have a fun applied program. You know, Audubon has a gazillion people who count birds.
Mm-hmm.
They have, and you have a system where you get people to recognize bumblebees.
Yes.
You get them to photograph the bumblebee, and you have a chart. Tell us a little bit about that project, because that seems to me where amateurs can actually contribute to scientific research.
Yeah, so I did not develop it at all, but Michael McKelvey, who is in the, I know I'm going to get the name of his department wrong, it's the Mathematics, Science, and Technology Education Department on campus. He developed the BeeSpotter website, and May Barenbaum came up with the idea. So it's a really great citizen science website that we have specifically for Missouri, Illinois, and we just added the greater Cincinnati area where I'm from.
Uh-huh.
And what you do is you can take a picture of a bee that you see on a flower. You submit it through BeeSpotter. You even have the option to try to identify it yourself. We have a key online that you can try to identify the bee. But once you upload it, an expert on the other end, which right now is me, will identify the bee and add it to our database. And BeeSpotter is really, really great. Some of the things that have come out of BeeSpotter is that, one, there's a threatened species of bumblebee that lives in Illinois. It's called Bombus affinis. We've identified what we think are stable populations of this bee in Illinois just by user-submitted pictures online.
Uh-huh.
You know, there hadn't been populations found in years in Illinois.
It's like an amateur finding an archaeological factor.
Yeah, and so now we know where some populations of this near-threatened bee are in Illinois. And then another thing is that we have brand new records of a species living here that was not known previously to live in Illinois, which is Bombus rufocinctus. We didn't think, so it's primarily, I think, a more northern bee for Canada. I think it spreads, I don't know the exact range of rufocinctus, but we didn't think that its range extended into Illinois previously. But then we started getting submissions of this bee that we didn't know, we hadn't seen it in Illinois before, and then we kept getting more and more records. So it seems like rufocinctus is, if it hadn't been here already, it is here now in Illinois. So it's a really great resource, and if you take pictures and you submit them, you are contributing really important information on the distribution of bumblebees.
Two minutes. Well, yes, we should imagine that in a year or two you'll be continuing this work.
Yep, I will be gone. I haven't made any sort of official announcements, but I guess I'm going to do it here on the radio. I have accepted a postdoc position at UC Riverside in the lab of Hollis Woodard. She's a new faculty member, and we haven't completely figured out what we'll be working on, but it will most likely involve bumblebee nutrition.
Uh-huh. Can you tell people what a key is? Because you mentioned a key.
Oh, yes.
So your bumblebee has a yellow stripe or...
Right.
Tell them, on-off data.
So a key is a guide that can help you identify a species. So it takes you through a number of steps to help you identify a species that you're looking at. And we have a bumblebee key that we developed for Missouri and Illinois. So say you take a picture of a bee and then you don't know what it is. So you go to the key and it says, on this part of the abdomen, it's yellow. Go to number 5. And then you go to number 5. And then you say it says, the thorax is yellow. Then you go to step 7. And it guides you through step by step to help you identify your species.
Yes. And you can do the same with plants. It's Linnean sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you give it a botanical name or a zoological name.
Right.
And so when you're talking about Bombus, that's a big species.
Yes, Bombus is a genus, and then within that there are about 250 species worldwide.
So I think we have to say thank you to Michelle Duane.
Duenas.
Okay, and thanks so much for coming and telling us about bees. I really know that there's a lot of public relations about it. And I'm interested in the fact that something's happened in Australia, something's happened in Argentina, something's, and it's different around the world. So
yeah.
I imagine you will be traveling around the world to find out
hopefully
about these little creatures. Mm-hmm.